Section number 26590, General Wilhelm Murr, Reel 7.
Saying that when Coote left the government, and I think Trigby Lee took over.
Then this defence agreement between Great Britain and Norway was signed. That was in May 41. And in that is that Norwegian units should be used either for the defence of Great Britain or for the or for use towards Norway. Related. Of course, we had already broken that by the people up at Iceland.
Indeed.
But then we thought always, I suppose they thought that Iceland and Norway are sort of part of the family anyway, so we'll see through the fingers on that. But when it came to us, the government didn't really like us to go south. It wasn't an easy go. What we didn't know was that you had a remarkable man called Wing Commander Scott Morgan, who had done extremely well in Battle of Britain. He was posted to 13th Group of Fighter Command up north and sort of watching us to see what the potential of the Norwegian squadrons were and so on. He was a sort of a shadow and part of Royal Air Force, and we didn't know about him. I met him, in fact, first time when he stood there at North Weald as our wing commander flying. But he was the one that recommended to the RAF that bring the two Norwegian squadrons south, which we take as a compliment, really. He evaluated them that way. And his word carried on and so on, but there was a resistance on part of Norway to do that. But RAF upheld his wish, and we sort of let it go. But then, of course, the operation sort of wasn't really directed then towards Norway as such, but it was defense of Britain, and then included, of course, a lot of offensive operations as well. But anyway, we came to North Weald due to the Royal Air Force wanting us there. And it was a very happy time at North Weald. North Weald is a place where we stayed the longest of all in Great Britain at one stretch. Mm-hmm. We were fortunate with Scott Morton as Wing Commander Flying in the first period. He really coached us into the way of Royal Air Force in this sort of environment. And we thought he was our own age. And we thought he had the world of wisdom, you know, that God could give any human being. And he had a way of presenting jobs so that you were running for it, you know. You were really wanting to do it. And I can never, ever remember that he ever gave an order for us to do anything. It was merely sort of slowly indicating that this is really what we want, and so before he could almost finish, we were on the go to do it. You know? And I think he was happy with us. Mm-hmm. He seemed to be. Of course, he didn't stay all the time, but we had wing leaders after him. That was not his light, but very good. One of them was Jamie Jameson, who had actually been on board the Glorious, when that was sunk in the North Sea North part on the evacuation from Norway. He and Group Captain Cross, they survived. There was only 33 survivors from that disaster. 1,500 people drowned, but that's a different story.
Yes.
But he was one wing leader we had after Scott Ball, a very fine fellow, and so on. I could name others. Mm. And we had a station commander. It was a South African, Sula Morris, became later head of fighter command, tremendous. Well, first, of course, we had getting old, you forget names. But I'd never forget him, though. But he was Pike, Marshal Pike, later Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Pike, Chief of Defense, Pike, Sir Thomas Pike. He was the first station commander, but he was soon taken over by Zula Morris. Tremendous fellow, you know. And we were very happy at Northfield, very happy at Northfield.
What was the main activity? Was it air defense?
Well, there wasn't so much air defense work. There was some air defense work where we took part in a normal way. There was, as the Americans got going and so on, we had a lot of fighter escort to them. Yeah. We had a lot of, we had some, still some naval patrol business, that's protection of the ships going into London in the estuary.
Thames Estuary.
Coming from north, down by Norfolk coast and that way. And we had attacks on shipping still, there was some of that. But mainly it was escorting bombers, not only American, but Boston's and RAF and so on into northern France. Of course.
When you did such an escort, how far could you go with them before you had to come back?
Well, in those days, we went with them all the time. They didn't go that far. Oh. Their type of airplane, the RAF didn't use the... This wasn't heavies. These were
medium.
Boston type, Blenheim's Boston type, and medium thing.
What sort of targets were they?
Orders, yeah.
What targets were they attacking?
Airfields, radar stations, bridges, transport, railway junction areas, and everything. Of course, one of the main thing at this time, as it went on, was to align yourself with the invasion to come. And so you became, especially from Christmas on, well, we were at Northfield about a year and a half. We had all these jobs. The sweeps with Americans were very, very much on. We moved sometimes down to Manson. We moved to Tangmere. We moved other places to as forward bases. This business of forward base, of course, was important to follow the bombers longer.
Were the Americans going for the same kind of targets as the British at that time, over northern France?
I wouldn't really know. Of course, the Americans had daytime tremendous accuracy in their weapon delivery. The British had their night jobs and so on. They were more... The target was more aerial.
Yes.
So at least it was somewhat different there.
When you were doing an escort, where would you position your fighter aircraft? Would you be over the bombers or behind them or beside them?
Well, of course, with these big bomber formations going on, there were many squadrons taking part.
Yes.
We were just, Norwegian Wing was just one of them. Mm. And you could be a diversionary job. You could mount a raid that was simply, hopefully, meant to draw fighters away from the bombers. And you could even stack light bombers in that sort of thing, just to turn the German fighters in that direction while the bombers did their go. Or you could be close escort, which was a dangerous place for these Americans. They were trigger happy like mad, you know.
Yes.
you came too close. They were
yes.
Hooting, you know.
When you were close escort, how close would you get to the... The bombers
you
were escorting.
You worked around. It would be a couple of hundred yards.
That's very close indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But to be within the range and then you had support airplane. You could be in front of the bomber formation. You could be a formation on top of it to stop clear the air there. So it was all sorts of mixtures.
Yes.
And when you had bombers, not the Americans, but these other bombers going into into Calais area and behind to Saint-Tome, which was the main airfield, to other places and so on. Then you had a system laid on so that you were close support to the formation that came, but you were target support, you were people going in ahead of them, just like we did with the shipping. And you had diversionary things, and it was a big thing, you know.
Large-scale operations.
But stuck in between these sort of things, you also had a special sort of operation we call rhubarb operation, which was very few planes. It could come down to two planes, four planes, could even be six. But, I mean, mostly it came on initiative from individual pilots, two friends saying, let's go. Let's find some target, let's go in and do something, you know. And they would come and seek for to be allowed to do this. And we wouldn't just let them go and do it. That would be too hazardly. So then you had to line them up with intelligence and see what worthwhile targets might be and so on. But if they were pretty keen and motivated, you should let them have a go too. It cost some pilots, surely did, but it was also nice in the squadron to see that people had the spirit to do that sort of thing. And so they were almost at times harder to stop them, to let them go, you know.
What kind of things would they be attacking on a rhubarb operation?
Oh, very much transport, railways, whatever moved on the things. There were too few to make an impact in a solid target. But this business of taking a fleeting target, and all that was something. So it was just to go and see what they found and enjoy themselves and come back. You know, that's what it was, I always said. But I always liked it when they came and asked for it, because but I also had to temper them so they didn't just do it just recklessly.
Yes.
Because then you would just lose them. So that was... another thing that we had a good benefit from in the Norwegian squadrons, that we in the Norwegian squad benefited from, was really that you got to give younger people when they arrived the chance to grow in the organization and not feel that you've got the system of above you, squadron commander, flight commander, and so on, and you can't get encouragement for growing. And that's very important. And it's like gangs. It's got all the implements of a gang, with what I would say a plus connotation.
Yes.
I mean, the purpose of the thing is good, not the street gang, but the purpose is bad. But it's got the same
mentality.
The same relations thing between people and so on. And you've got to feel that you have... One must watch recognition, that's one thing, but you also got to give them the feel that if they're good, their chances of growing in the system is there. And we did that, and the RAF helped us to do it too, that good people at the top, we didn't hang on to them, we let them off. So if RAF would take them for purposes of their judgment, either into their squadrons or into whatever, and so on, it gave room for growth in our own establishment. And that was a very healthy thing.
So you had a throughput then, people coming in
And they did a good job, but they went too.
Yes.
So everybody was happy about that, but it was a thing to watch, that it's a need for the younger to feel that way.
When you were doing these operations, escort operations over France at that time, were the Germans responding strongly?
Yeah.
Did they put in large-scale fighter attacks on the bombers?
You bet, but they usually waited until they knew that we had to turn back. And we had to turn back. You could see them as specks waiting for it.
Yes.
For us to turn back, you know. And then
because you were running out of fuel.
Yeah, we ran out. They knew it. They knew we can go that far. That was a sad thing to see, but we just couldn't do it. And then they had to be on the run. In the same way, we had to go out and meet them as far out as we could.
Coming back.
And then we could see them come, and gosh, did they look, you know, burning and so on, with milling Germans around them and so on when we got up there. And of course, from then on, we had to shepherd them at home. Mm.
And would the Germans break off and disappear when they saw you
approaching? Yeah, they were saving their strength, resources simply. They wanted to bomb us, not us, really, at that stage. But, there's a lot of that. it's a point that Americans really, at a time when they had these great losses, they arranged a meeting up at Belvedere Hall, wasn't it, at the headquarters, I think it was. And all squadron commanders from 11 Group and 12 Group, who was involved in this escorting business, we were called to be part, and I was there. And that was an experience in itself. The meeting called for representative from all the American wings around Norfolk and wherever they came from. And this was a broad picture of crews. There were pilots, navigators, gunners. They all came and they looked that way, you know, when you see Americans like that. In real, they flew in, you know, and they came. And it was in a big gymnasium hall. And it was led by General Aker himself, who was the head of the 8th Air Force. And the purpose was really to discuss and evaluate, and then, of course, make decision whether they could continue daylight operation at all, or whether they must change to night, like you did. And it was a very memorable, for me, an extremely memorable meeting, because you could really feel that you were inside the nerve system of these ground for these crews, you know.
Do you remember what was said at the meeting?
Oh, yes, I remember a lot of that.
Yes.
And he was really, General Aker was really leading. He was a quiet man, nothing bombastic about him. And he was leading the meeting with a very firm procedure. And everybody had their say, and we had our say. I remember there was a wing commander, Milne, who was a fine fellow, really. He slipped on a point by saying sort of that they didn't think it was such a problem, because with all their claims of having shot down so and so many and so on, it was only a question of waiting for a couple of months and there wouldn't be any German Air Force left. But you know, they weren't open for fun. Mm. It was a dead silence, and he felt himself that, my gosh, that wasn't a place to play a joke. You can do it in a bar, but this was not the place. And remember, we discussed in detail this business about formating on the and so on. How close do we dare? We warned them and said, "Don't ask us to come too close. That's too dangerous," you know, and so on. But that, you can allow yourself to say that. Mm. That's all right. But we discussed one thing which they took note of, and that is what it means if they aren't accurate on rendezvous points. Mm. Because if you come in with that big formation as they had, and we had big formations too, if we don't meet exactly on time and in the direction, you lose 50, 100 miles on what distance you can follow them.
Of course.
Turning around or things like that, or wait 10 minutes for somebody. No good. No. So after the meeting, the practical part was that the accuracy of rendezvous and the setting for the was very much better.
What was your view about the main question of daylight bombing or night bombing? Did you think they should carry on?
This, of course, was the issue on the whole, for the purpose of the meeting, to have this sort of thing. And I remember at the end of the whole session and so on, it was winding on, and Aker wanted to finish it off and so on. And I remember he said, well, anybody else have a view? And there was one coming up, so it was a bomb aim or something. And he said, General, may I have something to say? And he looked at him and said, you sure may, but it better be good. He had his point, and so on. But they decided afterwards that they would go on with the daylight bombing. And when you consider what that decision really meant, it meant that the Germans were giving no leeway in day nor night, or night nor day, for repairing, for redoing, for whatever. And it meant that if they had turned to night operation, it would have set the American Air Force back for a long time before they get going. That's a big thing to retrain an organization into from daylight to night, when they've set it, or from night to day, for that sake. That's probably easier, but that's a big thing. So it was, they said, we stay on night operation. It was a tough decision. Very memorable moment, really, on the whole thing.
And did you think that was the right decision at the time?
Oh, indeed. Well, if they could take it.
Yes.
There was at the end of the meeting, I remember an American high officer brought in from America, who came to boost the morale of that probably made the main impression of the whole session, to boost the morale of the crews. And he was telling about how what was going on in America, technology, how they would refit airplanes with guns, make them into flagships, how they would stack this in this formation, how they would go through and we'd go to Berlin and shoot our way both ways and on. And he had a sort of a salesman's pitch in a way. He had prepared himself tremendously, and it fell a dead silence after his speech. Nobody cared about what would happen about it a month ahead. Cared about what happened tomorrow. and he felt it. He crept out the back way. And I remember Aker just sort of looked at him. There was some dead silence. And he said, we'll go on with the discussion. A tense moment. All nerves right out of the, all along. Yes, it was a big thing. Well, anyway, this is a General Aker is claimed when the U.S. Air Force came to Britain, they all wanted him to be part of whatever will come and so on. But he was a modest man, apparently. I met him later in life, and he stayed away from all these sort of things, but except for one time. He couldn't avoid a meeting in Guild something, and God knows, maybe it was even the Prime Minister. I wouldn't know. And he had to say something. And they had just arrived. And his words, as his claim from one who was there, was that, well, we have come. We have a lot to learn. I trust when we go home, you will say, you did a good job. And he sat down.
That's a very modest statement.
Yeah.
Did you get the impression that his men trusted him when you were at that meeting?
Yes, very much so. Mm. We had a lot of admiration. There was a lot of cracks and jokes about the Americans in Britain, in newspapers, media, and I would say in the bar too, you know, in the beginning and so on. But we got to be pretty impressed by what they were taking, what they were doing, and what they were, the beating they took, and the way they took it. I must say that. And within the Air Force, I mean, within the Royal Air Force, there was no, you could have a crack of a joke, yes, but, you know, lots of admiration. Lots of admiration. Oh, yes.
Do you remember when it was you first realised that there was soon going to be an invasion of Europe? When did you first get the idea that there was going to be an invasion of Europe?
Well, we started. This started while we were at Northfield.
Yes,
it started in the late summer. 43. I wasn't involved at that time. I was squalid. I had my things and so on. But my friend General, or later General, but Colonel Merrim, he was drawn in. He was our wing leader at that time. He was drawn in preparation and so on. And from that time, we felt very much the direction of choosing targets and activity were planned as part of the invasion to come. And as you get closer to towards Christmas and so on, it was more and more of that. And I would say that the people who did that planning must be pretty brilliant, because it was known that Hitler very much had set his mind that Calais was the point, and so it was. And also what did we know? We didn't know so much, but we hadn't talked and laughed about things, but we knew that whatever the high-ups said and so on, when Hitler set his mind, it was a problem for them. So it became a sort of an idea that as long as you can fortify the idea that Hitler is right, then you have a far way to, then you've come a long way. And that you outmaneuver the professionals and play on him. And also I remember the selection of targets could start wondering why do they take that target and that target, but then that wasn't our business. It was something they did in fighter command or whoever. So we always thought that they had a good reason for what they were doing. But you could see the selection of targets increasingly was playing to convince the Germans that the attack would come across Calais and nowhere else. And it was a cunningly thing, because you mustn't let the other plots out. You mustn't make it too plain. After all, you're up against intelligent people. So you've got to do it subtle. And you know the army did the same thing. They mustered a whole fake division, or more than that, on the south coast, and had a play with radio going to make the Germans think that they were marshalling up, didn't they? Well,
they
you
did.
Know that
yes.
much more
and
than
and
me.
In East Anglia as well, they had a dummy army.
One job that we felt was very important was to be absolutely sure that the Germans didn't have capability to look into the south coast. So the air defense must be absolutely watertight.
Anti-reconnaissance.
Yeah, they must be absolutely.
Were you involved in doing that?
Yeah.
Patrolling?
Oh, yes, we were.
Were the Germans trying to get reconnaissance into the...
I suppose they did. But as far as we did, it was the same thing as before. It was no difference as far as we are concerned. And it was a question of selection of radar stations on which you... he would judge what you were doing. We were attacking radar stations primarily in the Calais area.
Yes.
To make him think that this is where we concentrate. One thing we had as a very much of a prime job was to push his air defense backwards, make him have longer distances and so on. But again, we did that more in the Calais area than we did it in the Normandy area. But you've got to do it there too, otherwise he would sort of start wondering what's there. But that fake sort of thing, or deceiving sort of idea, worked tremendously well as far as I can judge know it afterwards. I thought
looking
it
back.
Yeah, yes. Extremely well. Mm. Of course, it ended up with closing on D-Day, where you had bombers doing pips and things like that, and making circuits to believe that it was.